You're listening to an American Free Press podcast. Hello and welcome. On December 27, 2008, Israel launched a violent attack on the open-air concentration camp that is the Gaza Strip. Nearly 1,500 mostly civilians were massacred for three straight weeks. Horrific stories of Israeli atrocities were uncovered by the United Nations body authorized to investigate this ferocious military action. The conclusions reached by the informally named Goldstone Report shocked the entire world, except for, of course, Israel and its sole benefactor, the United States of America. Professor James Petras has written about this in his latest book, War Crimes in Gaza and the Zionist Fifth Column in America. I'm joined on the phone with James Petras, a Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in New York. Professor Petras is the author of more than 62 books published in 29 languages and over 600 articles in professional journals, including the American Sociological Review, British Journal of Sociology, Social Research, and others. He's published over 2,000 articles in non-professional journals such as the New York Times, The Guardian, The Nation, Christian Science Monitor, Foreign Policy, and many others. He has a long history of commitment to social justice, working in particular with the Brazilian landless workers movement for 11 years. Professor Petras, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation, David. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you, sir. Professor Petras, I just completed your book, War Crimes in Gaza and the Zionist Fifth Column in America. And, of course, it includes the executive summary from the United Nations Fact-Finding Mission on the Gaza Conflict, which is also known as the Goldstone Report. Now, Professor Petras, I want you, for our listeners, if you could, to explain these terms, Zionist and Fifth Column, before we go any further.
Well, Zionists are people who look to Israel as their prime allegiance in terms of national identity and affiliation. They may be citizens of the United States, but they believe that Israel is their fatherland. They carry out programs designed to enhance the power, wealth, and influence of Israel, even at the cost of the countries of residence, the interests of the countries of residence. Many of them are of secular belief, but there are also others who hold to a religious doctrine that Jews are a superior race and that Israel is the beacon for the realization of their pride of place. And I think one has to deal with this problem because it's not merely a ethnic group. It's a politically active group. It's a politically active group acting on behalf of a foreign power. And that's why I call it a fifth column. Their pervasive influence in civil society as a lobby is complemented by their penetration of important political offices, both in the Congress and the executive branch, where their principal activity has been to push the Israeli agenda, whether it's displacing Palestinians from their land, attacking Palestinian social and political organizations, or simply promoting wars with Israel's adversaries and countries which support the Palestinians. So it's a serious problem. If it was simply a question of an ethnic group that identifies with its place of origins, one could understand it. There are plenty of those groups around. But it has to do with power politics. It has to do with wars and peace. It has to do with American taxpayers' money going to fund an aggressive militarist society. and it has more important of all, the results of the Zionist Fifth Column has been to push the U.S. into war with Iraq and into a major confrontation with Iran. With Iraq, it was a case of destroying a not only a government but a society which was secular. It was run by a dictator, but it was a secular government with high levels of living standards, science. But most important of all, it was a country that backed the Palestinian struggle to overthrow an oppressive colonial regime. And the same goes today with Iran. The main driving force, the leading pressure group, the leading politicians that are pushing for sanctions and now putting the military option on the table are largely Zionist organizations like the Anti-Defamation League, American Israel Political Action Committee, and they've leveraged approximately 85% of the Congress to act as proxies for Israel in the United States.
What was that percentage?
80% minimum.
80% minimum. Okay.
We see that in votes. For example, on the sanctions to Iran, the vote was over 90%. With the repudiation of the UN fact-finding commission, the Goldstone Report, the overwhelming majority of congressmen didn't even vote, didn't even read the document before they voted against it, simply on the pressure of the pro-Israel organizations. They signed off on it, and they act pretty much like robots that are wound up by the Israeli power configuration in the United States, and they march.
Right. What brought you to this topic, Zionism?
The topic is largely a reflection on the circumstances surrounding the U.S. War against Iraq. When I was examining the political decision makers, I discovered a high proportion of people closely connected to Israel. And then I began my research on people like Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Abrams, Elliot Abrams, and Scooter Libby. And I found that there was a tie-in here between their close relations with Israel over the previous three decades and their close association with Israel in the lead-up to the war, and the advocacy of warlike policies, including the cooking up of the data in accordance with their wishes to destroy Iraq as a on behalf of Israeli policies and desires to expand its power base in the Middle East.
So prior to you studying the Iraq War, you had not written about or really concerned yourself with Zionism.
That's right. Roughly around 2002, I began my research on Zionism, Israel, and the Middle East. Right after 9/11, all of a sudden we were deluged with a campaign by officials in the government, including Scooter Libby, who's a prominent Jewish Zionist and was number one with the vice president's office. We had number two and number three in the Pentagon, Wolfowitz and Feith. We had National Security Counsel Elliot Abrams. He's a fanatical, lifetime Zionist committed politicians who've always pushed the Israeli agenda. In fact, both Feith and Wolfowitz had their security clearances questioned for handing documents over to the Israelis, or the allegations that they handed over documents. So this was a momentous moment for me to say, look, along with millions of Americans, we were out in the street protesting about the threats of war, and very few people were looking at the policymakers who were pushing this war agenda.
Right.
Then when the Axis of Evil speech by Bush was made, I looked at the speechmaker, was another fanatical Zionist, a fellow named Frum, who's a Canadian-American citizen. I looked at some of the prominent publicists in the media, people writing op-ed pages, Wolf Blitzer of CNN. I looked at Fox News, and lo and behold, the most ardent advocates of war were all Zionists, so people with a long history and trajectory of putting Israel first in our political agenda. So I decided this is a serious issue. This isn't just a question of U.S. power grab in the Middle East. And I began to examine alternative hypotheses, people saying, people like Noam Chomsky talking about oil instead of Zionists. I said, well, listen, let's examine that. And I looked at the lobbies for the oil companies, and none of them were pushing for war. On the other hand, looking at all the major presidents of the American Jewish organizations, all of whom are Zionists, Israel First is, and they were in the forefront. So how can it be big oil pushing for a war when there's no material campaign, there's no campaign funding, they're not writing op-ed pieces, they're not acting in the Pentagon, etc. This was a bogus issue. This was a distraction. And people like Chomsky and others who presumably our anti-war critics were covering up some important details here on the political process, how decisions are made in Congress and in the executive branch.
Right, and of course in your fine book you say on page 88 that it's estimated that as high as 60% of Democratic Party contributions came from Israel First benefactors securing an automatic 90% congressional vote on whatever issue the Israeli Foreign Office marks as priority for its U.S. fifth column. So what you're saying is they're really calling the shots here.
They're calling the shots on the Middle East. I think that's the important issue. They're calling the shots on any issue that affects Israel, any issue that Israel raises as important to its power interests. Now, they don't... This Zionist power configuration does not determine policy to Russia, China, what have you. It doesn't determine policy on immigration in Arkansas. I think one has to be very clear that the Zionist power and influence is focused on a single issue, how to enhance the power of Israel, even at the cost to U.S. taxpayer and even at the cost of a U.S. Lives, especially of our armed forces.
On page 112, you say that for Pelosi and the Zionized Congress, the thousands of campaign shekels from the AIPAC crowd to fund their reelections are far more crucial to their careers than the lives and limbs of thousands of U.S. soldiers lost to an agenda of Israel and its domestic fifth column. Professor Petras, you mentioned a term, Zionist power configuration. Can you define
that?
Well,
because some of the writers, some of the critics of Israel and Zionists talk about it as a lobby. A lobby is simply an organized group that goes out and pushes a political agenda. What I call the Zionist power configuration involves more than just a lobby in Washington. It involves 51 major American Jewish organizations. It includes local organizations at the city and county, municipal level, the state level. It includes politicians inside the government at the executive level. And it includes policymakers that are operating as advisors in particular, in the Treasury Department, Undersecretary Stuart Levy, for example, has been instrumental in organizing sanctions against Iran. His position on in finance and terrorism was created by AIPAC, and he was their candidate, and he got the appointment, got reappointed by Obama, and He's been in frequent consultation with the Israeli secret police, Mossad, the Israeli Foreign Office, and he's been extremely active in blacklisting and blackmailing any company in the world that deems to trade and invest with Iran. So we're talking about more than just a bunch of lobbyists hanging around Congress trying to get a bit of legislation on board.
Right.
We're talking about a systematic power structure here that moves on various levels, from the municipalities through local government. They're influential in getting trade union pension funds invested in Israel bonds. They are instrumental in getting companies to move their investments out of the Middle East with countries that are critical of Israel, etc. So we're talking about something which is a power network.
What I guess many people refer to it as ZOG, Zionist Occupied Government.
Well, they are certainly that when we come to dealing with Middle East issues in Israel. As
right.
I mentioned, we shouldn't generalize that to other issues. As I
right,
mentioned,
sure.
Trade policy with China, the relationships of the United States with Canada, Japan, etc.
Right, but it could be a slippery slope, because if they are this effective at dominating and controlling U.S. policy in the Middle East, couldn't they just as easily move their target onto something else?
Well, they can, and they have. Occasionally, they have pressured other countries. They currently have a campaign going against Turkey, a propaganda campaign, simply because Turkey criticized Israel's repression and blockade of the Palestinians in Gaza. By the way, an interesting point, exactly what Turkey said about Gaza, the strip in Palestine, is what the conservative prime minister of England, Cameron, just said. He said it's an open-air concentration camp.
Right. I don't think there's any disputing
that. Now,
what
that means is that more and more people are catching on, despite the power of the Zionists, especially in the United States. The rest of the world is getting wise to what Israel's all about and its repressive policies. Even the foreign minister of the European Union has attacked Israel for running a open-air concentration camp, Lady Ashton.
Right.
So outside of the United States, where we have these very powerful operations of American Zionism, both in the media and in political, financial, economic spheres, in other countries, that's not the case. When Brazil President Lula went to visit Iran and negotiated a settlement, actually, on the nuclear issue, there was a handful of Brazilian Zionists that got their collars up, but they had zero effect, zero organization, zero effectiveness, etc. The same goes in Argentina, and to a lesser degree, the Zionists are also influential in England and France. And, of course, Germany, they constantly blackmailed the Germans because of World War II and all that. But it's less a factor than it is in the United States. Here is really a Zionist-colonized political sphere as far as Middle East politics goes. There's nothing like it anywhere else in the world.
And I guess one of the great ironies to all this is that the country that they ostensibly are saying that they're returning to, they were never there, because on page 89 you say, as most contemporary Ashkenazi Jews are descendants of Central Asian Khazari converts to Judaism in the 8th century A.D. Isn't that right?
Yes. There's been a number of studies recently. Shlomi Sand has published a very interesting book in which he shows that the majority of Jews that stayed in Palestine after the destruction of the temple later converted to Christianity, and then with the Muslim conquest, they converted to Islam. So the real true descendants of the original Israelis are largely the Palestinians who were converted. And all the folklore that is used about David, King David, and Solomon, these are little hokey villages that virtually the folks tale about the great kingdom of King David, etc. None of the archaeological evidence sustains that. They were a small town rulers, and the whole idea that this is the home of the contemporary descendants of Israel is false. Most of the Jews migrated to the Middle East, to North Africa, to Spain. Some went to Asia and converted Asians, and then with the Mongol invasion, they migrated toward Eastern Europe, and from Eastern Europe to Central Europe, etc. So this argument is the same kind of story you tell children about Santa Claus.
Right. And of course, this Zionist power configuration, as you call it, it's not something new. As you say on page 108, it's been in existence for the last 50 years. Is that right?
Yes, but it's picked up steam over the years. From the 40s, they bought the support of Truman by making a big contribution that helped them win the 1948 elections. One of the big turning points was under Lyndon Johnson, when Abe Fortas and other Zionists, prominent Zionists, were in his inner circle. And when the Israelis sank the USS Liberty, deliberately bombing, napalming, and shooting up over 200 sailors, dozens were killed, Lyndon Johnson didn't move a finger to retaliate. He called back the airplanes that went to the rescue. He then imposed a silence with threatening court-martial on the survivors of the Liberty. It's one of the most shameful chapters in American history that an enemy attack on a major U.S. intelligence ship went unanswered, and that's largely because Lyndon Johnson was in the pocket of the Zionists. He didn't want to alienate them. He was still thinking of running for office in 1968, and there was a cover-up, and the American Zionists have never, ever owned up to the fact that their mother country, Israel, murdered dozens of American sailors and wounded over 100.
Right.
And there is a whole history of that. Whenever there's a conflict between the United States and Israel, whether it's on a policy issue or violating international law, the Zionist power configuration always takes the side of Israel. Always takes the side of Israel. Now, there are a lot of dissident Jews in the United States, and more so now than ever after the latest atrocities, the bombing of Gaza, the killing of civilians, the bombing of the humanitarian flotilla. But they're not organized in a scale that the mainstream Zionist Jews are organized. There's a silent majority of American Jews that don't care about Israel, and that's one of the secrets. They're not active, they're not involved in countering the message, but they're out there. Fact of the matter is, over 50% of American Jews don't even marry other Jews, and that's been a high figure, and some of the Zionists have been hysterical about this. Elliot Abrams thinks it's a form of genocide for a Jew to marry a Christian or whatever, an atheist. And I think it's the kind of racism that's rife among some of the leading Zionists.
Right, and these people are in high positions of power in the United States government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of them are in power, some of them are out of power, but they believe that there's a purity of the race. In fact, there's a whole highly funded, organized, so-called scientific group in Israel which goes around trying to find some genetic basis for being a Jew.
Right. It seems like there's a lot of similarities between Zionism and Nazism.
Well, in that sense of trying to find a genetic basis for a certain kind of racial purity, and I think it's one of the more disgraceful aspects of the Israeli Zionist establishment.
Now that the Zionist power configuration has been defined, let's get to the United Nations fact-finding mission on the Gaza conflict, which is also known, of course, as the Goldstone Report, which you say was the, in the preface, was the most systematic and detailed study of Israeli violations of international law in its wars against the Palestinians. There's a lot of parts to the summary, but if you could just give our listeners some highlights as to what the mission uncovered in its, I think they had something like 188 interviews, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And what they turned up through very careful observations on the ground as well as interviews and attempts to interview Israeli officials to get their side of the story, which the Israeli officials refused to do, they found that the Israeli attack on Gaza in 2008, December to 2009, January, was that they targeted numerous civilian targets, including United Nations-funded hospitals, schools. They bombed police cadets, traffic cops, etc., cadets that were graduating. What they discovered was that the Israeli invasion targeted civilians as well as military targets. In fact, the great majority of casualties, about 80%, were non-combatants, children, women. They targeted apartment houses. They targeted any productive facilities, water supply, sewage treatment plants. In other words, they committed crimes against humanity by any definition.
Right.
And the Goldstone Report documented this. And when it presented it to the United Nations, there was an overwhelming, over 120 countries voted in favor of it. The U.S. and its allies in Europe abstained or voted against it. But the vote was about 85 to 90% in favor of this documented report. It had a tremendous influence around the world and opened the eyes of a lot of people that were sitting on the fence and not sure about what happened because of the media reports kept presenting the Israeli assault as some kind of defensive action, that it was strictly a military operation rather than a kind of terrorism, terrorized the population, hopefully starve the Gazan Palestinians, drive them out of the country so they could Judaize the whole of Palestine. And as a result of this Goldstone report, it had an influence even in the governments of Western Europe. It was very hard to sustain a position in Germany when about 80% of the German population was condemning Israel's action, the same percentages in France and England, while the governments toadied to the U.S. And so I think the only place where the Goldstone Report did not have a major impact was in the United States, and that's because the media and the Congress took a position that the Goldstone Report was one-sided, that it was only presenting a biased account based on Palestinian sources.
Right. Now, Professor, you said the media, that sounds like a monolithic term.
Well, I'm talking about ABC, CBS, NBC. I'm talking about National Public Radio. I'm talking about the New York Times. I'm talking about the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times. That's what I mean by the Chicago Tribune.
Right.
They had a uniform position. Now, if you go on to Pacifica Radio, some of the a lot of the blog sites, if you go into Information Clearinghouse and other places, you got a totally different picture. But for the mass media, and that's what I'm talking about, the Israeli position was echoed without any attempt to actually report what the Goldstone Report was saying. As I mentioned,
right,
in Congress, the great majority of congressmen never read the Goldstone Report, but they voted to condemn it.
Right. I actually interviewed Congressman Brian Baird, who had been to Gaza three times. He's from Washington State. He read the report, and he told me he's sure no one else did. Of course, it's almost 600 pages, wasn't it?
Yes, but you could have at least read the draft summary.
Right. Why read it when you just take your marching orders from the government of Israel, which is incredible to even think that that is the case, but in fact, your research shows that it is the case. So the mainstream media, are they taking their orders from the government of Israel?
Well, I think if you look at the ownership pattern, you'll find a good deal of pro-Israel media moguls, and I think that's one big factor. Washington
right.
Post, the New York Times are all owned and operated by people very close to Israeli state and who, and over a long period of time, have echoed the Israeli positions. And I don't think this is simply a coincidence. I think there's an affinity here, even an ethnic affinity, that influences how they handle the news, especially on Israel. Their choice of op-ed writers and propagandists, etc. It's a kind of incestuous relationship.
The mainstream media came in and defended Israel's actions for even violating, as you say in the book on page 18, the Fourth Geneva Convention, which applies to, of course, the protection of civilians in time of war.
Yes, that's unfortunately the case, and it's continued since then. It's a question not of a one-shot deal. It's not just Gaza. It's what's gone before that. Jenin, Ramallah, the constant attacks are still going on. They bombed some shepherds they claim was too close to the border between Israel and Gaza. kids throwing stones at some watchtowers that the Israelis have, get shot down by snipers. It's an everyday occurrence, and it's an ugly situation.
The Zionist power configuration swung into high gear without
even
reading.
Yeah, they defend everything. I did a survey of the main propaganda organ of the presidents of the major American Jewish organizations over a five-year period, and I didn't find a single criticism. There wasn't a single act of Israel, no matter what they did, killing of farmers, olive pickers, preventing pregnant women from going to the hospital, you name it. And there isn't a single instance that I found where these American Jewish organizations affiliated with Israel ever deviate one line. I mean, the Stalinist communist parties really have a competitor if you are looking at slavish following of a state's policy.
Even though, as you say, Israel holds some pretty disgusting world records. Can you tell our listeners about those world records?
Well, they've destroyed more villages than any other government in the world in recent times. They have been condemned by more UN resolutions for violating human rights than any other country in the world. They have engaged in the systematic occupation of another country for the longest time. They have shot down more airliners than any other country in the world. So one can run down the list. They've engaged in wars attacking Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, etc. For the longest time. So What can we say? It's a country that's extremely militarist, and it can act as it does because it gets the most modern arms from the United States, thanks to the influence of the Zionists. They don't even pay for their arms.
Right.
They get over $3 billion a year from the U.S. taxpayer, even though the standard of living in Israel is higher than 45% of the American population. Israel gets more foreign aid than the whole of Africa put together, and then some.
It's disturbing that we have, it seems like we really don't have a voice to stop this.
Part of the reason, there are voices, but they are one other factor here that we have to recognize is the tremendous repressive powers. If you speak up, you can lose your job. You can get fired. They go after people. They call them anti-Semites for criticizing Israel or some of the machinations of the Zionist organizations. And they have fired dozens of academics for criticizing or denied them promotions. So people are very fearful.
Sure.
I've talked to scores of people, journalists. Anyone, Oliver Stone makes some comments about this Zionist influence in the media, and immediately he's forced down to his knees, and he apologizes for saying something which is a recognized fact.
Right, like, for example, the Jews created Hollywood. That's a fact, but if you say that, you're an anti-Semite. Now, I'm glad you brought up Oliver Stone, because today they're talking about his apology for remarks about the Holocaust is not satisfying some folks. Of course, they always want more. That happened with Mel Gibson.
Well, they like grovelers.
Do you think he's going to grovel?
He's groveled.
He's groveled already.
Groveling. He's down folks. There.
Right.
He's bended knee.
Media.
When Obama dared to raise some questions about, and Biden, to Netanyahu, because he was knocking down Arab houses in East Jerusalem, the Zionist lobbies got on him, and Biden was down on his knees, even after he was insulted, personally insulted by Netanyahu during his visit.
Right.
And when Netanyahu defies a proposal by Obama to stop the settlements to begin a negotiating process, when Obama questions, "Why are you doing this?" the Zionists get on him, and he's shaking hands and kissing Netanyahu on both cheeks.
Right. It's, like I said, I don't know what to say, but this Oliver Stone matter, it's exactly what you're talking about in your book. Media mogul Haim Saban is trying to get Showtime to cancel Stone's upcoming 10-part series, A Secret History of America, and it goes on to say that he told The Wrap, I guess that's some kind of publication, that Super Agent Ari Emanuel, the brother of White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, so on and so forth. So these Zionists are really in positions of power that can influence your average American who really doesn't have the time or the desire or the inclination to really investigate these facts.
Well, yeah, and not only they don't investigate because they're frightened of what the conclusions will be. Look, take the case of Rahm Emanuel. He served in the Israeli army in 1990. He volunteered to serve in the Israeli army. He's never served in the U.S. Armed Forces, and he's the principal presidential advisor inside the White House. Here's a guy that's an Israeli citizen setting the agenda for the American presidency.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was saying. From reading your book and your other books, it really does seem like it is a Zionist-occupied government. Of course, you say we have to be careful, that it's really mostly directed toward the Middle East, although there is the possibility that if they select another target, they would be just as effective.
They'll probably be as effective. The big problem of dealing with other issues is mobilizing their financial and mass base, because what motivates the big financial contributors is if the I word is attached to it. So if they were to expand to issues that aren't directly related to Israel, they wouldn't get the backing that they do when they put the I word up. When they put the I word up, they get their financial machinery in place. They get the grassroots organizations to start writing letters and pressuring the local legislators.
Mm-hmm.
The I word is extremely important in the exercise of power.
Right. So after this Operation Cast Lead, after the Goldstone report, and Goldstone himself was Jewish, after that report came out, the 188 interviews, 10,000 pages of documents, 30 videos, 1,200 photographs, 300 reports, what did the U.S. Congress do?
The U.S. Congress voted, I think, something close to 400 to, I think it was 10 or 11, to condemn the Goldstone report. And despite the fact that Goldstone was not allowed to discuss his own report before Congress, he offered to come and discuss it. Now, mark you, Goldstone himself is pro-Israel. He's Jewish. He considers himself a Zionist. He even has a grandson that was going to have their bar mitzvah, his coming of age ceremony in Israel, and American Zionists and some of their counterparts try to bar him from going to the to this ceremony of his own grandson. So you know that they, whenever there are dissident Jews that speak truth to power, they also come under ferocious attack. They're accused of being self-hating Jews, agents of the Arabs, etc. It's a pretty ugly business when they come to defending at all costs a militarist state.
Right. Even after the 1,444 Palestinian casualties versus the 4 Israeli casualties, even after 240 policemen were purposefully killed, Palestinians waving white flags were shot and killed, and even when Israeli soldiers told Palestinians to leave on purpose, they were killed, even after evil weaponry like white phosphorus and dime weapons were used. The U.S. Congress still denounced the report.
Yes, that's true. And every single one of those acts of violence, those violations of humanitarian law, each and every one of them was supported by the Zionist Fifth Column. Not one of them stood up and said, this was too much. This was terrible. They burned people alive with phosphorus. Not a single word came from B'nai B'rith, the United Jewish Federations, Anti-Defamation League, and any of the major religious congregations, the conservative variant, the reform variant of Judaism. Not one of them stood up and said, this is too much. Enough. Israel's committing war crimes. Not a single voice came from the mainline organizations.
Right. And a particularly disturbing part of this Operation Cast Lead on page 25, of course, besides the human suffering, which was horrible and horrendous, was the story you told about the armored bulldozers going after the chicken coops.
Yes, there wasn't a single area of human existence that they didn't try to destroy. They even shot up fishermen trying to catch a few fish to feed their families. So I think we're dealing with a totalitarian policy that looks at driving the Palestinians out, either feet first or forcing them, making life so untenable that no human existence is possible. And that's they seem to have liberalized the inflow of supplies, but it's only about a fifth of what's necessary each day, 150 truckloads coming in, and nothing going out. That is, if you open a business in Gaza, you can't ship any of your products out.
Right.
So this is what's considered a step forward by Hillary Clinton and Obama.
Who are committed Zionists along with Biden. He publicly even said he was a Zionist.
You've got the three musketeers.
Right. And on page 26, the mission comes to the conclusion that the facts ascertained indicate that there was a deliberate and systematic policy on the part of the Israeli armed forces to target industrial sites and water installations. We were talking before about the Zionist power configurations, power, and how they get people fired and they threaten people. Are you afraid?
No. I've been through a lot of situations, and I think we still live in a democracy. I'm going to speak out. I've spoken out on other issues, and I'll speak out on this issue. I think Americans have a right to speak out. And I was in Chile during the Pinochet dictatorships.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Central America on human rights observation teams when there were death squads around. I'm certainly not going to back off because some Zionists try to engage in any form of intimidation. So that's clear, and it's been made abundantly clear over the past 10 years, and I think it will boomerang if any forcible attempts are made. I think it will only call more attention to their un-American and dictatorial means in the United States.
Right.
I think we have to stand up for America. If we don't stand up, who's going to stand up?
Absolutely. You've gained the attention of the Anti-Defamation League. You're on a few of their pages. They don't consider you, I think, an anti-Semite yet, but they consider you, I guess, an anti-Zionist left-wing professor. Is that right?
Now, that's fine.
Yeah, that's
fine. The point is that I've been engaged in years past in fighting real anti-Semites, people that hate Jews for being Jews. I've been actually, in physical appearance, I'm the stereotype. I look like a Jew, according to the anti-Semites, and I've had some pretty forcible confrontations over the years past. So they'd have a hard time pinning any labels on me.
Right, and actually I was wrong in this piece on the ADL's website where they're talking about Palestinian-American Hesham Talawi, about his weekly cable show, Current Issues, says that a right and left-wing anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists, including, and you're one of them, are you an anti-Semite?
No, of course not. And I think that the Zionists and the anti-Semites have a lot in common in terms of their policies of discrimination, fomenting hatred. While the anti-Semites foment hatred against Jews, the Zionists foment hatred against Muslims and Arabs and Middle Eastern people and against critics of Israel. So I think there's a symbiotic relationship here, a convergence between Zionists and fascists.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a chapter in your book, War Crimes in Gaza and the Zionist Fifth Column in America, where you talk about the Dubai assassination. You say Israel has a publicly stated policy of violating the sovereignty of any and all countries in order to kill or abduct its opponents. Now, this is a public policy they have?
Yes. They publicly defended it, that they have the right to cross borders and get who they target. They do it through their secret police, and they've engaged in this, and they've gotten into hot water in several countries. In Norway, they killed the wrong guy, a guy that they were targeting, and killed a waiter instead. They've been involved in stealing passports to carry out their summary executions, etc. So they've been doing this. They claim they have a right to do it, and it's really one of the worst aspects of Israeli foreign policy, that they don't respect national sovereignty.
Okay. Now, your book, Professor Petras, War Crimes in Gaza and the Zionist Fifth Column in America, if anybody's interested in picking this book up, and I highly suggest they do, they can go to claritypress.com.
Yeah, and also Amazon.
Amazon, okay. So it's either Amazon or Clarity Press, and that's Clarity Press, of course, .com. And how many books on Israel and Zionism?
Four.
Okay. Professor Petras, I want to thank you so much for your time. It was very enlightening, and I hope I can have you back in the future.
Thank you very much, David. It's been a very fine afternoon.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care.